Welcome to our salute to veterans here on AM 1430 WBEV and also streamed on dailydodge.com. We do this program each year to salute our veterans, but just as importantly, to make people aware of the sacrifices that those men and women make in the service of our country. Sacrifice when they put their hand up for the oath, no matter what occupation they take up in the military. When they take that oath, they know there could come a time when they may have to lay down their life or their limb for our country. Sacrifice on their part, also sacrifice on their family's part, the family that they leave behind, the family they're not with for their term of service. We salute our veterans at Good Karma Brands, and we want to tell you about the fine sponsors of this program who also take great pride in the service that these veterans have performed for our country. Today's program is brought to you by White Construction, Beaver Dam Community Activity and Services, Gina Olmig, your State Farm Insurance Agent, by K&B Trees, Lawns, and Lawnscaping, Richelieu Foods, by Air Care, by Kaiser Chrysler Center in Watertown, and by Hupp's Repair here in Beaver Dam. Our featured guest on this Veterans Day program is a young man who is a native of Beaver Dam, who served his country, wrote a book, and then took on a very interesting challenge. I should say he took on the challenge and then wrote a book. Our guest is Nate Hankus. Nate, welcome to the program, and thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, and it's my pleasure to serve this country. It just feels like the right thing to do sometimes, to serve others.
Tell us a little bit about your background in Beaver Dam.
Yeah, so a Hankus, I think anyone listening to this has probably encountered a Hankus at some point.
There's a bunch of them around.
Yeah, absolutely. So my father is Steve, and my mom is Virginia Hankus. And nothing remarkable about me growing up in Beaver Dam. Just went to UCPS and then Beaver Dam High School. I was in track and field and played soccer. And I pretty much knew early on that I'd be joining the military. But I think 9/11 cemented that decision.
So what year did you join and how long were you in?
So I joined in junior year of high school. There's a program where you could go to basic training in between junior and senior year of high school. So I joined in 2004 and I was in until 2009.
You chose the Army. Why?
I think I knew some people that were in the Army National Guard, some of my brother's classmates. And it always, you know, felt adventuresome. And I think I really didn't look at any of the other service branches. It was always Army. I think I was, you know, when you're young, you're looking at all these romantic notions, like, oh, the U.S. Army Rangers, those guys are awesome. And Special Forces guys, those guys are awesome. You know, it's just all this childhood dreaminess. And I was working through a lot of that at the time. So I was definitely gravitated towards the U.S. Army, and that's where I ended up.
You mentioned 9/11. It came at that time period. And what were your feelings at that point?
Well, I think I got caught up in the sweeping nationalism that went across the nation at that time. It was confusing for everyone. It was unprecedented. And, you know, it really felt like we were being challenged as a nation. And, you know, I didn't really know much about the broader world or geopolitics, but it felt right to put yourself in a position to help bring things back in order out of the, you know, it seemed kind of chaotic for a while. So it felt like the right thing to do is help restore balance in the universe. So that's what I gravitated toward.
And when you came back, you started questioning some of that motivation, and that is where the book came about, your hike on the Appalachian Trail and your struggles with that. We're going to get back to that a little bit later on. First, I'd like to talk about your service a little bit more. So you joined up. Did you join with having a particular occupation in mind, or did you kind of leave it up to the Army to decide, which they usually do, where you were going to go and what you're going to do?
Yeah, they definitely determine where you're going to go. So initially, just the naive notions and just watching too many war movies, I was like, yeah, I want to be infantry or like a Cav Scout or something. Super gung-ho. I was watching all the war movies, and my dad had the presence of mind to say, hey, you should like talk to my friend John Othout, who's he's in the National Guard and spent a lot of time in the military. So we had a one-on-one meeting, and he's like, you don't want to do that. That's, you know, super dangerous, and there's not much out there for you after you get out of service. He said, you should look at this up-and-coming technology. It's called drones. Like, there's unmanned aerial vehicles. So I looked at it. It looked pretty cool. And I took the tests to get into the military, and I scored high enough that they said that was a job that was available to me. And fortunately, there were openings. So I did sign up to become a drone operator. And that sent me off to Fort Huachuca, Arizona for 6 months of training to do that. And that included...
Did that 6 months of training come after your basic training then?
Yep. So after basic training, I went in between junior and senior year of high school. So after basic training, I came back to high school and I served in the reserves for that year, where just right across the street from the high school is the reserve center. But they knew I was going to go full time. And pretty much, I think as the week of graduation, I ended up traveling down to Arizona to begin my advanced individual training. And that included things like ground school. There's an entire, I think, a 6 or 8 week course on how to identify military equipment from like a bird's eye view. So it'd be like, oh, this specific Russian tank, you'll notice like a black dot on this back corner, and this is the shape of its turret and all those things. So it was pretty interesting training. Definitely far different from what I was learning in high school, that's for sure.
I'm really kind of computer illiterate. But, you know, when I've seen people fly drones and do things like, it kind of looks like you're doing a computer game. Is that with a joystick? Is that kind of it?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually talked to a pilot, like a professional pilot for one of the major airlines. I was like, you know, I was just downplaying what I was doing. He's like, and I said, you know, I basically just point and click, you know, that's the plane's fairly autonomous. We're just kind of pointing on a map where we want it to go. We'll click somewhere and it'll go that direction. So I wasn't even using a joystick. It was just all computer based. And then he laughed and he said, that's kind of what I end up doing too. So I guess they're using some of that technology up in on that space. But yeah, it's mostly like point and click. And what we were doing is, when you were operating the plane, there were multiple jobs. I was operating the camera sometimes, I was operating the aircraft, or I was mission commander. So when you're operating the aircraft, you're basically looking at the airplane vitals the whole time. Like, okay, what's the engine temperature? Where's our fuel at? Are we holding our elevation steady? And we had this whole list of procedures that we had to have memorized, and they test us all the time on these. Do you know them? Do you know them? Do you know them? We drill on them all the time. Like, hey, if all of a sudden the engine starts overheating, what do you do? And there's all these different things. So it was kind of one of those jobs where I always felt kind of anxious. Like, okay, this is, you know, I've heard anywhere from like $250,000 to $500,000 piece of equipment. I'm 19, 20 years old, and I've got my eyes glued. I'm looking at the engine temperature, I'm looking at the elevation, and I'm making sure I'm in the correct airspace.
So there were three crewmen basically for each flight?
Yep. Yeah. And they were all from the same platoon. We just kind of rotate. And what I'm referring to is kind of our rotation as how it was when we were deployed in Iraq. So, you know, 12 to 16 hour shifts, we would just kind of rotate each day who does what. But there's a person who'd be the pilot, which I kind of described, and then the camera operator, and that's the joystick. And that required some skill, you know, like if you're trying to follow a car through like the streets of Baghdad and you're, you know, all the cars look the same, but you're trying to follow one car, you really can't let it go off frame ever. And things can be chaotic and sometimes there's turbulence. So definitely requires some skill. And then the mission commander is someone who would be from the crew, and they would actually be in a different area from the operators. They would stay in this tactical operating center, where it's basically like the nerve center of the combat space. So you basically had one guy, the battle captain. He was like the orchestrator for the entire combat space that our brigade was responsible for. And he would know, he'd be directing battalions to, you know, this neighborhood to do this mission, this neighborhood to do this mission. And so he really wanted us to be nearby so that we, you know, if he needed to see progress on how a mission was going, or if there was an attack and he, you know, he wanted to have an understanding of the battle space, what was actually going on, so that he could make better decisions on what kind of resources they needed, then that's when he'd call on us, say, hey, UAV, I need you at these grid coordinates. And we'd go check it out and try to get him some good imagery.
Could you perform interchangeably among those three crew people? Could you do all three tasks that were required to fly the drone?
Yeah, absolutely. And for a while, we were doing the operator and the mission commander. Like, we combined those for a little bit. So you'd have a, which wasn't ideal because we were in a because the operator had to be in like the shelter, which is basically just a big box on the back of a Humvee, you know, one of the military trucks. It's a big box, a bunch of computer screens and a couple of chairs. And that's where we'd operate the aircraft out of. So for a while, we were just kind of on a radio talking to the battle captain. And this was really, we were just trying to reduce the amount of manpower we needed so that people could get more sleep, or when people were going on leave mid-tour, it just allowed us to extend kind of our manpower that we had within the platoon. But yeah, everyone could do all the jobs. It's all interchangeable. Yeah.
You talked about keeping the camera on a particular vehicle. Yeah. Explain to us what the drone is doing. Is the drone flying in circles? Because you're obviously going too fast airspeed just to stay behind that one vehicle. How does that work?
Yeah, so the aircraft would fly anywhere from like 3,000 to 15,000 feet. And it would generally, it would just fly in circles with like a 1.2 kilometer radius. You just kind of pick an area you wanted to survey, and then the aircraft would circle around that particular grid coordinate. And then if you were like following a vehicle across the city, you just kind of keep, if you're operating the aircraft, you just kind of keep clicking, you know, the direction you're going, and it just kind of like keep resetting where it's flying at circles based out of. And then the camera person would follow the vehicle as best as they could. And there was, sometimes we could just lock on, the camera could lock on pixels of a specific color. So sometimes you just be able to hit a button and the camera would just lock on to the top of the car, but you could never trust it because, you know, if it went underneath some trees or behind a building, then it'd break and then your camera would just kind of go off into nothingness. So it was always best to do it manually. It was interesting. It was high pressure, to say the least.
Were you trained on one particular type of drone? Are there different types of drones?
Yeah, there's a lot of different types of drones. And when I got in, it was the early days. So there weren't that many. And the one I was trained on was the Shadow T UAV. And it was built basically for like an older style of warfare. It was like a system that was designed so that we could break it down at night and drive and meet with like the troops that are pushing the boundaries forward and just keep like leapfrogging every day as like the legions of troops extend the territory forward. But we ended up just setting up in one spot and operating from that spot the whole time. So as far as drones, I mean, there's drones that I think, like, commercially FedEx is getting into drones, and there are drones that are the size of like normal jets, but ours was fairly small. It's 14 foot wingspan and 14 feet in length.
Did the Iraqi military have the wherewithal to be able to shoot drones down? And did you ever see a situation like that?
Yeah, there were definitely times where we'd get reports from the mechanics who we would actually land. We would actually hand off control of the drones, and all the maintenance and launch and recovery was in a different part of the city, which I was fine with. I didn't have to do the launch and recovery, which was always nerve wracking. That was just a whole other unit took care of all that. But there'd be reports like, hey, there's like a bullet hole, like, or in the propeller or something like that. Mm. So I feel like some people just take pot shots at them, but really our technology was just so overpowering and overwhelming that there wasn't really much that they could do. And at the elevations we were flying at, they might be able to hear it on a clear day. They hear kind of like the buzzing, whirring sound of, you know, the small engine. Kind of sounded like a lawnmower, honestly. And so they might be able to hear it, so they know it's up there, but the chances of being able to see it were pretty slim.
Did cloud cover basically rule you out?
Well, we had infrared, so we could definitely see through some of those things. It was more, I mean, there were definitely days where the clouds would be so low that we just didn't have clearance. Just our system, you know, if we got too much condensation in the air, we'd worry about things freezing. So there are just times where, hey, we can't fly today just because it's not safe for the aircraft.
Did you ever crash a drone?
Thankfully, I never did. But there are several times where it's called a magneto failure. It's just something that just seized up, and then the plane would just drop out of the sky. That happened a few times. Fortunately, I was never the one controlling the vehicle at that time. But that was something I was always definitely worried about.
So from what I understand from what you said earlier, you really weren't responsible for landing the craft, which is probably the most dangerous part of any flight.
Yeah. So it was actually pretty efficient the way they had it set up. They just had a unit. That's what they did. They did it so often. They were just so proficient at it. And, you know, they'd launch it. We'd get airspace clearance. And we'd say, all right, take it up to 6,000 feet, and then we'll take control of it once you're there, and then we'll fly it to our airspace. That's basically how it worked. And it was good.
If you saw something, you were also able then to, well, let me ask you this question first. Was the drone armed?
It was not. So that was one of the things early on where I thought, you know, going in the military with all these dreams of like special forces and Rangers, I was like, yeah, I want weapons on it, but now I'm glad we didn't. If we needed air support, we just work with a Apache helicopter unit. So, you know, if we saw someone doing something, or, you know, we were chasing a vehicle that we thought was linked to like a attack, then we just call Apaches and walk them on target, and then they would do what they do. But going back, I just want to tell you a couple stories going back about planes crashing. This would give you an idea of the battle space. So there were a couple of times where we had the drones crash, like in the combat zone. One time, plane crashed, and the local Iraqis, you know, pulled it out of the ditch, brought it onto the road, and flagged down the American troops and said, hey, we found this, you lost it, we know it's yours, here you go. So I was like, hey, cool, they like us. And then there's another time we were circling this house for 24, 48 hours, just trying to get an idea of who's coming in and out. And we know it's a high value target. And this is like a mission that generals are aware of, hey, what's your progress? What's going on? And, you know, it's this long drawn out anticipation, you know, it's where I've been on target for almost 2 days. Everyone's like, oh, when are we going to raid it? When are we going to raid it? We're still waiting for clearance, still waiting for clearance. And then the plane crashes. So, oh no, we lost our visuals. We're super like, I don't know. And so we pick up another airplane and we go back and we find the aircraft and it landed like right in front of the house that we'd been monitoring for these past 2 days. And they, you know, that neighborhood was fairly violent and against U.S. Occupation. And they pulled the plane into the middle of the street and just lit it on fire. Like, all right, well, we're not going to get that one back. That just gives an idea.
Was it a mechanical malfunction that brought it down then?
Yeah, that was pretty much what would happen with them. Like I said, that magneto failure, those, if one went down, is generally that.
Okay. We're going to come back and talk more about that. And when we come back with the next segment, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about, you know, your actual deployment in Iraq, what it felt like to be there, what it was like to live there, things like that, and more of your experiences there. Today's program, our salute to veterans here on AM 1430 WBEV and also on DailyDodge.com, is brought to you by Hupp's Repair in Beaver Dam, by Kaiser Chrysler Center in Watertown, by Air Care, by Richelieu Foods, K&B Trees, Lawns, and Landscaping in Beaver Dam, Gina Omega in Beaver Dam, your State Farm Insurance agent, the Beaver Dam Community Activity and Services, and by White Construction, Beaver Dam. We'll be right back right after these messages. Welcome back to our Salute to Veterans here on AM 1430 WBEV. Each year we talk to veterans who sacrificed their time, their talent, and in many cases, their physical well-being in order to serve our country. Today's featured veteran is Nate Hankus. He is a Beaver Dam native. Nate served in Iraq for 4 years, came back, walked the Appalachian Trail, which we're going to talk about in a little while, and wrote a book about it. And that's the book, if you can see it there, Waking Up on the Appalachian Trail. I must say, it's a great read. It's an easy read. It's a fun read, and it's also a read that makes you think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was definitely thinking a lot when I came home from the service, that's for sure.
You sure were.
And thank you. Just for clarification, I spent 4 years in the Army. 14 months of that was in Iraq.
Okay.
You said 4 years in Iraq.
That would be quite a term. Well, let's talk a little bit about Iraq. So, you fly over, I assume.
Yeah.
You get off the plane. Your first step into the Iraqi air, into the heat, into the atmosphere. Yeah. Do you remember that first step?
Well, it happened in stages. So we flew commercial all the way to Kuwait. And we stayed in Kuwait for, I think it was 2 weeks. And that was interesting because you're getting used to the desert climate. And we were going to shooting ranges, and you'd see like camels in the desert. Like, wow, this is very foreign and exotic. And then it started to feel real. Like, all right, our first people are starting to go to the base. They're going to get us figured out where we're actually going to be staying. You know, more like the logistical type people. And then batch by batch, all right, we've got a helicopter ready. We're going to take, I don't know how many people they take, 24 people at a time or something. And when it came my turn, when we first land down, first it's kind of chaotic because I got there at night into this base, Fob Falcon in southern Baghdad. And it was pretty much the whole time I was there, it was considered like a high danger area. So there weren't many visitors or anything like that. Like, every once in a while you'd have like these USO tours where celebrities would come through, but they couldn't come through areas that were considered dangerous. But the first steps I take, chaotic because the helicopter is just whirring. It's dark. You can't really tell what's going on. You've got all your gear with you, like everything you're going to be, your weapon. You've got, had a footlocker that I was dragging around, had big heavy bags. And Pretty much the first thing, I almost got knocked over just by the force of the turbines on the helicopter. You know, you got your body armor on, you're all hot, sweaty, and bothered. Okay, helicopter takes off, starting to like gather my senses, but things are still kind of chaotic. You obviously don't know the lay of the land yet. And all of a sudden I just start hearing like major explosions. And everyone's like, freaking out because it's their first time hearing these explosions. And you've got people who've been in there for a couple weeks already, like the logistics types of people. They're like, oh, that's outgoing fire. Don't worry about it. All right, all right. And then they, you know, it was actually during the winter that I got in there. So I guess people might find this interesting. There is kind of like a rainy season during the winter months. So we're dragging all our stuff through puddles and we get situated. Basically in a large tent that probably held 50 people or something like that. So my first impressions were just disorienting because it's at night and just uncomfortable because you're dealing with all your gear and this unfamiliar situations and just uncomfortable, I'd say, is the best way to put it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the comfort level and the heat.
Yeah. Yeah. The hottest I saw it, it was in the 120s, I believe. Like you would see people walking across like cement, and some days it was pretty hot. You'd see like the soles of their boots would leave like melted rubber on the cement because it's so hot. They would leave water, like pallets of water bottles around the base. Just, you know, they want to have the troops hydrated. So they just kind of leave them in areas where people are walking through, but they're in the sun all day. And there was a time where we must've been getting water shipped in for use in showers and things. And those trucks kept getting attacked. So they just told us, hey, you need, where you're not going to have water for a while. Use your water sparingly. So we had to ration water. But that was the middle of summer when you're dealing with 120 degree temperatures. So it's like, man, I want to take like a little bath here, just with like a little hand towel or whatever, just wipe off. So I grab one of these water bottles, dump it on a washcloth, and I like put it to my skin, and the water is so so hot. I just jumped up. It's like, oh, I can't do that. I have to let it cool down somehow. But yeah, it was pretty interesting.
Do you ever acclimate to it to a certain extent?
Yeah, I think you do. I think, and I was fortunate. You know, I don't take it for granted, and I was well aware of it because I was watching the combat space on a daily basis. Is that I did not have to wear my body armor most of the time. Because I was on base, I was on the, you know, in the airfield area. And so I was able to acclimate to it. I don't think anyone would get comfortable carrying like 80 pounds of gear in that type of heat, and I still do pretty good in dry heat. Like it can be, I ended up working in agriculture. So sometimes I'll spend an afternoon in a greenhouse. It kind of gives me like a familiar feeling and I can handle it pretty good. So I guess something changed in me to be able to handle that.
Tell us a little bit. Well, speaking of the heat, there's one part of your book where you talk about you have the drone going, and you said you would see couples on nights when it's 100 degrees plus go up on the roof and sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if they didn't have AC, you're going to do something to get comfortable. And yeah, you'd see people just move their like foam mattresses to the roof and just sleep out on the roof, just maybe to get some air movement or some sort of relief from the heat. Mm-hmm. And that's rough.
So you said 12 to 16 hour shifts?
Yeah, so flying was generally 12, and then sometimes we'd do security duty for 4 hours after that, and that would be guarding something on base somewhere.
So you were really never called on to go out on patrol or anything like that?
No, I was very fortunate in that sense. At first I thought, man, I'm really missing my opportunity to you know, make an impact. And then once the reality of combat became like crystal clear, because I'm watching it all day, I'm seeing Humvees explode and, you know, burn in the middle of streets and, you know, just some horrific things. I would say, well, yeah, I'm glad. I'm very fortunate that I have the job I do have, and I definitely had the utmost respect for anyone that was out on the streets and they did not have a good time.
Well, you were experiencing the whole battlefield with all of those. And, you know, they talk about the band of brothers and that special relationship that builds a special bond between combat veterans as they're serving. Did you feel that?
Certainly. It's a family. It's definitely a dysfunctional family, but it's a family. And I still keep in contact with a lot of the guys I deployed with. And, you know, it's just interesting to see how life is playing out for everyone. You know, some people are overcoming the obstacles and excelling, and some people are still struggling with the darkness. And, you know, I do my part to kind of share aspects of my own journey to help them out where possible. But ultimately, you know, it's up to each of us to make it through to the other side.
Dysfunctional family while you were there. I mean, people from different parts of the U.S., different cultures.
Oh, yeah.
You mean the big mix?
Yeah, it was people from all different cultures. And I was kind of like this naive Roman Catholic kid from the Midwest. And then we had people that like grew up in and out of the correctional system as kids. Maybe they joined the military to get out of going to prison or something like that. But for the most part, everyone was really intelligent, because you had to test at a certain level to get this type of job. And yeah, just all sorts of walks of life. You know, there'd be times where, hey, maybe the best way to settle this dispute is just a good old fashioned fist fight. And that was still, it was all, I think it was mostly men, probably like 95% men in our platoon. So I guess that's probably not your average family dynamic, but yeah, even the ones that we'd get in fights with, it's still family at the end of the day. You know, you're still in the same place. You're still relying on each other to get by. You
know, okay. Yeah. I want to talk about some of your actual combat experience over there in terms of, you know, calling in attacks and the like. But before we get to that, there was one interesting point in your book where you were watching a man who walked out in the street, and then you said infrared, you picked up a heat signature of something out. Do you want to explain that one, Nate?
Yep. So this was a common mission that we would fly at night. You know, and we did have a curfew in the city. So anyone that was out at night was already kind of suspect. Like, hey, they're breaking the law. Let's keep an eye on this person. But in this particular night, we saw someone on the side of the road. You know, it's infrared. You know, it's nighttime. Like, okay, what's this guy doing? He's kneeling down, crouching down. I can't really tell. Keep circling around to get a better look. Maybe he's digging a hole in the ground, which would mean maybe he's emplacing a bomb, you know, an IED, which at that time they were getting a lot of, killing a lot of U.S. soldiers with that technology. So we were really like vigilant about this. So we're watching him. We're saying, hey, we're not quite sure what he's doing, but there's a high probability he's doing something illegal and he might be in place in an IED. So we're going to keep an eye on him. Battle captain at this point, we got eyes on. I've called the Apaches. They see him, and, you know, let us know what you see. And if you do see a shovel or something, that would be the rules of engagement would say, yeah, we can take him out. So keep looking. He gets up, he starts walking away. All right, what do? Do I try to like see if there's a bomb there? Do I see where he's going and kind of mark the house that he's at? And maybe that's like an IED manufacturing facility that we can raid later. And I'm searching, I'm like looking at it, like, no, man, that's not a bomb. This guy just took a crap. So he was just squatting down on the side of the road in the middle of the night, just walking wherever he was going. And, you know, it was close. You know, the tension was in the air, like, hey, we're just give us the word and we'll take this guy out because he's obviously doing something wrong. And then fortunately, like, the resolution was good enough that I was like, no, that's definitely not a, like, it's not like a signature outline of a, armament. It's this guy just went to the bathroom. if only he knew how close he got that night.
I was going to say, it is so indicative of the seriousness of the decisions that you had to make. And you obviously made some decisions where you did call in the Apaches to make an attack on someone or something. You want to talk about a few of those situations?
Yeah, there were times.
I must say, you didn't bring that up very much in the book.
I didn't bring up, like,
the real combat situation.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there were times where, yeah, we would see groups of people and they would have weapons and it'd be night. And that was a pretty clear cut case. And a lot of times what we were, like, the call for fires that we would do would be, say, we knew we were raiding a facility and we were watching it. And then troops would come, and then, like clockwork, everyone would go up to the rooftop and start running from rooftop to rooftop to rooftop. And, you know, sometimes they'd drive away, and then you'd get Apache on the car, and they would just take them out. Or sometimes they'd hide in something. Like, sometimes they'd hide in, like, boxes on top of people's houses. And then we had the ability to kind of show the troops on the ground where they were, just kind of painting the area with something that they could see with their night vision infrared or with their night vision goggles. And then in those cases, we'd capture them because it's actually better to capture them because you could get some information. There was like a perimeter around Baghdad, and every once in a while we'd see people put up bridges, ad hoc bridges. And we saw one guy come across one day. He had like a bag in his arm. It definitely looked like the shape of like a old artillery round. And we would, you know, we followed him in his car, followed him to his house. We're looking at his house as he walks into his house, and they're like, go back to the car. I like go back, I try to find the car. It's like, I don't see the car. And then I zoom out. Oh, the Apache already destroyed the car. And then I go back to the house and the house is gone. It's like, oh, where's the house? Like, oh, the house is gone. So decisions would happen like pretty quickly and things could go pretty quick like that. There was one time where we took out a bridge because we knew that like the insurgents were using that particular area just to transport munitions and whatnot. And we saw someone that had a piece of heavy equipment there, and they're kind of rebuilding the bridge. And I actually still have some video of this on my computer. I don't think I'm able to show it to people, but Apache comes and blows it up as it's like working. And then, so I see that, and I'm kind of zoomed in on the piece of heavy equipment at that time. And then all of a sudden in the frame, you know, from the camera, you see the Apache fly right through the frame as, you know, the whole like background is like smoky of all the dust that comes up from that type of explosion. And that was like a very, you know, at the time it was very like, yeah, gung-ho, we're cheering about that sort of stuff. And yeah, there are all sorts of missions. It was, I'd say in the first, I got there in February of 2007. I think it was like our first 5 or 6 months. I think we lost around 90 people in that time. It's just super violent time period. There was a civil war going on. And yeah, we just kind of every night there'd be something going on, or there's some units that we were working with that they were just in such hostile neighborhoods. We would know like something's going to happen tonight. And there'd be days where, all right, 212's got to go do a mission in this neighborhood, and I know something bad's going to happen. And sure enough, like, hey, we got the call. You got to go back to 212. and there'd be a Humvee upside down in the middle of an intersection, smoke billowing from its burning tires, and just chaos on the ground, people on rooftops, just like shooting. You know, they set up an ambush, and then just the ability that my unit, the drones operators, that we were able to give the battle captain that vantage of like, all right, how did they set up the ambush? What buildings are they on? What would be like a safe point of egress, or what would be the best way to stop the people that are firing on us? And, you know, in those moments when we would like, I guess, just stop them, those always felt like, okay, I'm doing something valuable here. You know, I'm not the guy pulling the trigger, but I feel like I'm a force multiplier here. You know, being skilled with the camera that I can, you know, if someone does run, I'm able to keep up with them, and, you know, I'm skilled enough at my job to be able to do that. And yeah, those are the types of missions that we'd find ourselves on quite a bit during that violent period early on in the deployment.
You took out some incoming rounds, mortar.
Yeah, certainly. So yeah, like I said, our base was considered like, I forget what like the threat system they used, whether it was like red or like five stars or whatever, but is considered dangerous. And there was, yeah, we'd take a lot of incoming fire. This was kind of probably my first month in country. I was in the tactical operating center, so I was mission commander for the day. And, you know, I'm still nervous at the job. It's kind of new, you know, figuring out airspace. I'd be real nervous, like, oh, can we get like our airspace for the night so we can actually do our mission? I'm still nervous about that sort of stuff. And all of a sudden, like we get the drone, everything's looking good. All of a sudden, it's like the movies. It's like a whistling sound, and it's a whistling sound that crescendos in this like a curdling, like hair raising screech, and then it's just a thud that rattles your chest. And it was just one after the other, like whistle, explosion, and battle captain when the first one hit, you know, the wars have been going on for a few years at that point. So he'd been deployed a couple times by then. He's like, this is hostile fire, people, take cover. And, you know, we'd go to the ground. I think I was still green enough and naive enough that I was still like, I didn't go all the way to the ground. I felt like I had obligations. But you could feel it in your chest sometimes. And the way mortars work is it's just a tube, and then they basically just like lob it. It's like a tube. They launch a projectile down it, and then it kind of follows that arc as it like launches out of the tube. So they'll just kind of walk it around. Sometimes they'll have like visual, like, hey, we need you to like move the tube a little to the left so that you can hit that building. And so you could like actually hear and feel them like kind of aiming and kind of walking the mortar rounds. Sometimes they'd walk away from us, and sometimes they'd walk towards us, like, hey, are they trying to walk it on target, like on us right now? We didn't know. And that at a certain point it just stopped. It was the all clear. And then, all right, well, is everyone okay, battle captain? Is everyone okay? Yeah, we're all good. And I'm saying, what's the coordinates? You know, if we know the coordinates, we can swing the camera over there and maybe we'll see like a vehicle driving away, and then we can just follow that. And we did get the coordinates, but in that particular case, they were long gone by that time. But later on in the deployment, there was probably like, I don't know, it's two weeks maybe, where we were just getting mortared every day. And you could just feel morale going down. People were, it kind of like shuts down any sense of normality that you might like lull yourself into when you're overseas and on a base. Like it might feel relatively normal, just like a factory gig. Like, all right, I'm on shift work. I just go to work. I try to work out when I get off shift, I eat and then I go to bed and repeat. And it can start to feel like a normal type of job. But then once these mortar rounds are coming in, you know, every day for a week or two, then it's like, okay, you got to carry your body armor or wear your body armor with you. You have to carry your ammunition with you. And we're closing down the chow hall because that got hit with a mortar round and started on fire. So now we're on MREs and now it's really feeling like I'm in a combat zone. And I wasn't on this particular mission that night, but it's basically the same thing. Rounds came in. All right, let's get the coordinates. Got the coordinates of where they came from. Went over there, saw a car driving away that time. All right, perfect. So follow the car, call the Apache, get the Apache to see the exact same car we're looking at. They blow it up, and then silence for like a month afterwards. And everyone was so happy. The battalion commander came, and he talked to the drone crew. And there's a thing in the military where like leaders of units will have coins. And he like gave the crew on mission that night this coin. Good job, guys. I just got my first full night's sleep in a long time, so I wanted to thank you guys. So that was pretty cool. And that was kind of like a feather in a cap for the effectiveness of the type of work that we could do over there.
Yeah. No, it wasn't from a mortar attack, but you lost a friend there.
Yeah. Yeah.
First name, Franklin Steele, Frank Steele?
Frank Cady. In the book, I go by Steele. His name was Frank Cady. He was a young guy, just like me. We're about the same age. And we were roommates at the time. There's probably like a group of... By this time, we had moved out of tents, and we were kind of squatting in this old abandoned, bombed-out factory. And there were like 10 of us in this room. And yeah, one night he went out on mission, and I don't know if he was driving with by night vision goggles or not, but for whatever reason, when he was driving, he steered the truck. They were going through like a checkpoint, so the road's narrow. Then you have to go through these big cement barriers because they also have to be bomb proof, and he hit one of the cement barriers, and the gunner who was on top of the truck, he could kind of tell it was coming, so he like locked in place, but his face kind of like got messed up. And the driver, Frank, he died right there, and there were a couple other guys in the vehicle as well that they didn't have any physical wounds, but they're not obviously still carrying that mission with them. And for me, that was just a hard go. I was actually on leave when it happened, so I didn't hear about it until probably a couple of days after it did happen when I came home or came back from leave. And I was excited to tell everyone about, you know, my time. I had backpacked through Europe during my leave, and I could just tell the energy was off. The mood was down. I said, hey, what's going on, guys? Like, Frank died. And I, like, hey, you guys are putting me on this. You're like joking with me. Nope, he was out there. This is what happened. And we were on mission that night, and we've had to like provide surveillance for it. And, you know, we knew at the time that it was one of our guys. Didn't know the name at the time, but we knew that's what had transpired. So if you think about that, it's kind of a mental, something that you don't want to wish on anyone to have to do that. So, you know, we had the funeral. You know, I had like such pent up stress and anxiety and all that, that kind of became a period of release for me just to let go. I couldn't really control myself with the grief in that moment. But at the end of the day, just there is no time to grieve really, other than you shed a few tears and then, all right, you got to get back in the shelter and get on with your missions. And I think that's, you know, a lot of people hold on to that stuff for years because they don't necessarily have the ability or mental bandwidth, or maybe even like the emotional skills to be able to process those sorts of experiences. And unfortunately, in a combat zone, those things can happen over and over again. So it can be rough on people.
Well, processing all of that is in a very interesting part of the book that you wrote, Waking Up on the Appalachian Trail, which is a mixture of telling the tale of actually walking, I believe it's 1,200 miles, the Appalachian Trail, and your thought process in thinking through what had happened to you in Iraq and your feelings and thoughts about Iraq. And we're going to come back to that after we take another break here. Our program brought to you by Hupp's Repair, Kaiser Chrysler Center in Watertown, by Air Care, Richelieu Foods, by White Construction in Beaver Dam, by the Beaver Dam Community Activities and Services, Gina Omeg, your State Farm Insurance Agent, K&B Tree, Lawn and Landscaping, and by, as I mentioned before, Richelieu Foods. We thank all of our sponsors for bringing us our program today, and we'll be back with Nate Hankus right after this. Welcome back to our Salute to Veterans here on AM 1430 WBEV. We're also doing this on video on DailyDodge.com. You can go to DailyDodge.com and watch it. And we're also streaming it live audio on DailyDodge.com. And this program will be available at a later date for you to watch. Tell your friends about it if they haven't seen it. You can go to DailyDodge.com and just click on the video tab, and you'll be able to see our Veterans Day special today. Again, later on. Our guest today is Nate Hankus, who served in the U.S. Army for 4 years right after 9/11. He actually joined the Army as a junior in high school, which a program I'd never heard of. He took his basic training between his junior and senior year, came back, finished out, and then went into the Army and served in Iraq. When he came back from Iraq, Nate, you decided to do quite a challenge. And let's talk, first of all, just about the Appalachian Trail. I had never heard of it before your dad told me about your experience and I read your book. Explain to our viewers and listeners exactly what the Appalachian Trail is.
So the Appalachian Trail is a national scenic footpath that spans from Springer Mountain, Georgia, to Mount Katahdin in Maine. It's actually 2,148 miles.
I'm sorry, I said 12, I cut you short.
That's I definitely feel those miles someday days. So there's a segment of people that decide to hike the entire length of that trail in a single season. And they have from roughly March until October to do it. And those people are called through hikers. And I had met a through hiker when I was in the Army, someone I had trained with, and it just got my imagination going. And that was the first time I had heard about it. And I decided that when I got out of the service that that's something I would do. So I'm going to through hike the Appalachian Trail. And my brother, Ben, joined me because he was just getting out of college at that time, and it was the Great Recession, so he didn't really have any major hot prospects for straight out of school. So I think it was a good transition for him as well.
Well, tell us about the trail itself. This is not a sidewalk.
It's not
a footpath, and much less than a footpath once in a while.
Yeah, so we actually, most people will hike from Georgia to Maine because like the ending in Maine is really scenic and you have to climb this large mountain called Mount Katahdin at the finish. So it's kind of like a storybook ending to this long adventure. But I got out of the Army kind of too late to be able to start in Georgia and finish in her hike in time to end in Maine. So we hiked from Maine down to Georgia, which is maybe like 10% of through hikers attempt that. So yeah, we get to Maine. It's a very rugged landscape. I'd never spent much time there, and it's kind of what you'd expect, a lot of pine trees. The mountains are fairly rugged. There's a lot of glacial activity in that region and a lot of ups and downs and mosquitoes and rain. And I believe Mount Katahdin is somewhere close to 6,000 feet. And then I think you're climbing something like 3,000 feet to get to the top of it. So it's just a big day for us to start the trail. And my dad actually hiked Mount Katahdin with us, and because they drove us out there. My mom and dad drove us out there. And then when we called them the next time we got in civilization, like, yeah, your dad lost three toenails from the hike. And it did take a minute for the body to get, I don't know if it ever felt fully comfortable but you know, sometimes the hiking, especially with the packs early on, the packs were heavier than they were towards the ending when we kind of pared down our gear to the barest essentials. So it was it's challenging on the body. And you can imagine that in the course of these 2,148 miles, that your feet really take a beating. So, you know, you'd hike towards like midway through, we're hiking maybe 18, 20 miles a day on average. And when you wake up in the morning, your feet are so swollen, you're like limping to get out of your sleeping bag and take care of your morning chores. And you just strap on your shoes, like, okay, we're gonna go hike 20 miles today. That's pretty much every day. Just required a lot of discipline. But there is this like it's like Americana, you know, it's like a fabled hike, and there's a culture around the Appalachian Trail. It attracts a lot of free thinkers. It attracts people who are maybe don't fit into the cookie cutter, you know, American dream type lifestyle, and they're just more restless, or they're, you know, they maybe value adventure and freedom more than others. So for coming from the military, where everything's so structured and disciplined, and I'm thrown into this, into the wilderness, you know, it's up to my brother and I to plan our mileage. You know, what are we going to do? Where are we going to stay? So we're starting to get this level of freedom. And then we're just meeting people who are, you know, I was envious of the freedom that they had as I was watching them and how they navigated through life. And so I was inspired by, you know, the way that people were showing up in life. So for me, it was not only the education of, you know, learning how to be successful at like a long distance endurance type of activity, but also just learning from those around me who, much like the military, came from all different walks of life. But it seemed like the people that the trail attracted were like a far cry from the people that the military attracted. And that's what I needed at that point in my life. Because you had alluded to it before, but when I got out of service, I felt very confused. I felt like, you know, I don't really feel as if my mission overseas really helped anyone, or like, was it about 9/11? Was it about, you know, I just didn't have that level of certainty, and it just caused this confusion, and it kind of gnawed at me, and it's just this very unhealthy energy inside of me. So I was also looking for answers and for just some way to get out of my own way, get out of my own head. And you know this, anyone who's into literature would know this, but it's like this motif in literature that people will go into the wild places to find clarity and peace. So I think that's what I was drawn to go on the trail, even if at the time I wouldn't have been able to articulate that. Pretty sure that's what was going on under the surface.
Well, you for sure did find what I would call a philosophical mentor along the way.
Yeah.
Name of Dylan, and we're going to come back to him, but I want to talk a little bit more about your specific experiences on the trail. You ate a lot of ramen noodles.
Sure did. And you get sick of those pretty quick. but they're super lightweight and they have calories. So it was something that was just practical to carry. So I ended up losing about 34 pounds over the course of the hike. This is like, and my brother didn't lose much weight. He's a smaller person than me. And I think he had like hit some sweet spot of being able to carry the perfect amount of calories. It was strange. I'm still trying to work that one out. But The food itself, in a given day, you know, I'd wake up, I'd have some oatmeal. Maybe I'd throw some like M&Ms in it or something. And then for lunch, it's generally like, I probably have 6 to 8 different types of granola bars, maybe Snickers, and I just dunk them in peanut butter. And that was, you know, calories. All I want is calories, calories, calories. And then dinner was usually like 2 packets of ramen and one of those foil packs of tuna. And I just boil the water in a little camp stove. A jet boil is what I used, and just eat that right there. And that was pretty much every day. And then at a certain point, my brother and I were just trying to drop as much weight as we could so that the physical toll on our body wasn't, wouldn't take as much out of us. And we wouldn't even heat our food at a certain point. We just kind of soak, like in the morning. And this was probably just to be efficient with time as well. We just like get cold water, pour it in our oatmeal, kind of shake it together and just kind of like half drink and half chew it so that we could get on the trail right away. So it wasn't a very comfortable or leisurely type of journey. It didn't feel like a vacation. And actually there's a point in the trail where I was like, you know, I was kind of looking for freedom, but you have to be super disciplined to be able to accomplish something like this. And part of me was like resisting that. And I didn't play around with that a lot in the book. You know, just, you know, a lot of us find ourselves in situations that we put ourselves into. And, you know, sometimes our reality won't meet our expectations. So how are you going to respond to that? Are you going to accept it? Or are you just going to be like sad about it the whole time? So there's a lot of lessons.
There was a lot of discomfort for you on the trail. Along the way, you know, you talked about the food rations and the like, but every once in a while you'd come across where you could stay overnight, a bed and breakfast, so to speak, yeah. And you'd come into towns and tell us about some of your an experience or two in a town where you go in and load up on pizza and the like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's, you know, it's part of the experience of hiking the Appalachian Trail. Obviously the communities around the trail know through hikers, they kind of know what to expect. And some people will leave coolers of food out for hikers where you're just walking through the woods. Maybe you're close to like a road intersection and someone will drop off a cooler that has sodas in it or some sort of food in it. And that's considered trail magic. You know, anyone who does like a good deed on the trail, they're considered trail angels. And that's, one of the recurring themes of the book is that the trail provides. So, you know, you might not even know you need something, but then the trail will provide you this lesson or this piece of gear or this food at this time when your morale is really low. And then of course, you know, you're in America, you know, it's a populated area. So every once in a while, the trail will cross a highway. And when you cross the highway, if you're out of food, then you just put your thumb up and hitchhike into the nearest town. So we did get to have like good conversations with locals and say, oh, tell us about this area. Or sometimes you'd feel like you're in a position to entertain them. So you'd be telling them stories about the trail and try to be entertaining. But yeah, there'd be times where, just for example, we were in Marion, Virginia, and we had hitched into town and we were walking through town to get to a Walmart because we needed to stock up on some food. And someone pulls over and he's kind of like this goofy, awkward guy. He's like, hey, my name's Gonzo, which is like first a red flag, I guess. He's like, I want to show you something. I want to show you my house and invite you up there for dinner. So we're driving around and see the house. He's like, come up here when you're done in town and I'll have dinner cooking for you. And my wife will cook some, I forget what it was, apple dumplings, I believe it was. And yeah, just the generosity of people. And that particular night was kind of awkward because you had mentioned Dylan before. He was hiking with us at that point. And he was dealing with a case of Lyme's disease, unbeknownst to him. And he had like ate so much food, and he was having like these symptoms of Lyme's disease that he just got almost like catatonic. And it was just really awkward for everyone. Like, okay, you ate a lot of food and you were like carrying the conversation the whole night. And now this is just really awkward. So it was fun. And I think people realize that thru-hikers are, you know, they're experimenting. There is kind of like a party culture with like the younger crowds that hike the trail. And I think some, you know, people who are familiar with the trail kind of embrace that, or at least deal with it. And, you know, we made friends on the trail, friends with people that we had no reason to ever meet before. And they were so generous. People would give us food from their coolers if they were car camping. Sometimes they'd drive us around to go find some beer. And it gave you faith in humanity. And, you know, as divided as the country seems or as it is, it just was a reminder for me that, you know, we're all just trying to get by and trying to be good people, trying to be good humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there were nice people, and there were some people that weren't so nice.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, if people aren't nice, it means they're probably in pain in some capacity, which I don't think I had that insight at the time. Mm-hmm. But we did have people that would make us question whether or not we had the ability to thru-hike the trail. Like, there's this one lady who had thru-hiked the trail a couple times, and I don't know, she was just in a mood that day. She's like, oh, you guys will never make it. She was like, oh, you look preppy with your Patagonia this and your North Face that. And I've seen 1,000 people like you, and you never make it. So that kind of made my brother and I say, well, can we do it? We don't know. But by that point, we had hiked some of the most challenging parts of the trail, because we started in Maine, like I said. And that's Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. Those are some of the most mountainous territories on the Appalachian Trail. So once we made it through that territory, we're like, okay, we got this. As long as we can like keep our mental game strong, we know we've been able to overcome like the most demanding physical aspects of the trail. The rest is just endurance and just stubborn. Stubborn is too stubborn or dumb to quit. So it's kind of our motto.
You ran into a bear one night.
Oh yeah, we ran into several bears. There was one night, this was in Virginia, and we had decided that we were going to hike at night. We did a full day. We did our 20, 24 miles that day, but we wanted to get to the highway in the morning, and so we could do laundry and get food and get back on the trail. And we knew the road would be like 11 more miles away. So we're like, we're just going to hike to the road. And then that way, you know, we could sleep in a little bit, but we'll still be able to get into town early and be able to do all our chores. So we decided, okay, we hiked our full day, 24 miles. Let's eat some food here. And then we're going to go back on the trail and hike another 10 or 11 miles. And we're at a shelter. There's people there. We're talking. We're having these conversations. And we're cooking dinner. There's like a group of a few of us. And also one of the guys like kind of stands up. He's like, hey, there's a bear over there. And I turn around and I just see like head of a black bear pretty close, maybe like 40 feet. And it's just kind of sticking its snout up in the air, like sniffing, because we're cooking dinner. So it can smell the ramen. It can smell the tuna. Like, okay, that's one bear. It's basically a big raccoon. Just keep an eye on it. No problem. And then also my brother, someone in the group is like, oh, there's another bear. Wait, there's another one. And it just kind of seemed like, you know, they were all around us. I don't think they were like trying to do a coordinated attack or anything, but they were circling the area. And, you know, we had dinner. We were keeping an eye on them. And the sun goes down, it gets dark. And then my brother and I are like, all right, well, we're going to go back on the trail, because we had already made up our minds. So we picked up some rocks in our hands, and we're I had to hike back to the trail proper because sometimes the trail will fork off to get to like a shelter area. And I can explain those as we move forward. And we go back to the trail and we hear like some rustling in the bushes next to us and throw our rocks and start yelling, you know, like, hey bear, you don't want to like surprise a bear, could scare them and they'll attack you. So we knew that much. And we've, you know, it's pitch dark, but we've got our headlamps on and they shoot out a light beam, maybe 20 feet or something. We're just walking along. We're both kind of like anxious because we had just had like these encounters with these bears. We're walking. My brother's in the lead. And all of a sudden he starts to slow down. There's something like in the middle of the trail. They're like, oh, is that, it kind of looks like a tree stump or something. All of a sudden it turns around and you see the eyes light up and that's a bear just right on the trail. And it ambles off into the forest and start yelling again, hey bear, hey bear. And then we just keep on walking. It's a pretty,
we only have about 5 minutes or so left. Okay. So you finished amazingly. You did this entire trail. How long did it take you? And I know your dad and his brother met you at the end.
Yep. So it ended up taking 1 day shy of 5 months. And we ended in Springer Mountain, Georgia, hiked the last 30 miles with my dad and his brother, Paul, my uncle, Paul. And, you know, it was just one of these experiences that it's very uncommon. And I put myself and my brother and I were in situations that would be hard to find and seek out in normal day-to-day life. And I think we both grew from the experience. We both grew from the people we met along the trail. And we grew closer in just for having these experiences together. Anytime we get back together, we're reminiscing about the trail, telling stories, trying to remember things. It was a good experience. And I tried to put it all down faithfully in the book and also share some of like my inner journey of healing and dealing with the like psychological trauma of war. And like you said, I did encounter like a philosophical mentor of sorts, and he definitely stretched my mind with introducing me to ideas that were foreign to me, different ways of thinking. And I tried them out, and you know, I encourage the readers to read along and consider the message that I'm sharing. I think it's important. I took the time to put it down in a book because I thought it was a way to continue my service for the community, because that's just a part of my DNA, I guess. I wanted to be of service.
I found it extremely interesting as you moved through on the trail, considering all of these different ideas as you were hiking and the like, and the way that you mentally processed all of this. You were listening to Dylan, who is that philosophical mentor who had a specific point of view.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. You listened to what he had to say, then you internalized it, and you came up with what I thought was a great solution in the end, that it basically comes down to you as an individual.
Yeah, your personal responsibility. Yeah, personal
responsibility as to how you approach things and how you take actions in this world,
and right.
It has an impact on the rest of the world.
Right. Yeah. In an era where it feels like a lot of social contracts are disintegrating, I think it's an important reminder that, you know, each of us, you know, every day with our actions, and we're influencing the outcome for everyone else. So I think it's a good reminder from that, in that regard.
You have been great. This has been a great, it's been great just listening to you explain. I read the book and I still found this extremely, extremely interesting, Nate. Now the name of the book is Waking Up on the Appalachian Trail, A Story of War, Brotherhood, and, as Nate just said, The Pursuit of Truth. How can people get this book?
Well, it's on Amazon, pretty much anywhere you can find books online. If you just search Waking Up on the Appalachian Trail, You can also purchase it from my website at nbhankus.com, and I'll gladly sign it and ship it off to you. And you can even talk to my parents. My mom's been selling a book or two as well. So if you know them, by all means, get in contact with them. And it's on audiobook as well for anyone who's does a lot of driving with their job or has time to put in headphones at work. You can get the story on the go.
Did you do the audio part of the audiobook?
I did not. I started it, and I realized that was not a gene that I had, so I delegated that task. It was I'm really happy with how it turned out. I worked with a voice actor. His name is TJ Clark, and he really has like a good emotionality to his voice, which I thought really lent a lot of power to the words that I wrote. And I think he did a really good job, so I'm happy with that.
And you are now a chemist working in the agricultural field, living out on the West Coast.
Yes, I am. I slowly migrated west after some internships out west. I went to school in River Falls. I did a master's degree in Utah, at Utah State. And then I fell in love with the ocean. And now I live about 10 minutes from the ocean, and any chance I can get, I'm playing in the water. So
great.
Yep. Yep. It's been a good journey.
Thank you very much for taking the time to do with this. And again, thank you for your service and the sacrifices that you and your family made during the course of your service.
Yeah, thank you for your curiosity and for your service to the veteran community and the community of Beaver Dam. Thank you so much for your time. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, Nate. This has been a salute to veterans, and we want to thank our sponsor, White Construction of Beaver Dam, Beaver Dam Community Activities and Services, Gina Omeg, your State Farm Insurance Agent, by K&B Trees, Lawns, and Landscaping in Beaver Dam, Richelieu Foods Beaver Dam, Air Care in Beaver Dam, Kaiser Chrysler Center in Watertown, and Hupp's Repair in Beaver Dam. November 11th, Veterans Day. Remember our veterans. Remember the sacrifices that they and their families have made so that we have what we have in this country. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a good afternoon.